Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Tech problems last week killed us in check, but we're good to go this week, and God, you know, gives us them great days, and we, you know, life's full of peaks and valleys. But the American Sports History Podcast here, hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend, Peter Ray, live in Cleveland, Ohio. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing in Los Angeles, 347-205-9631. If you happen to miss it, 30 goes by quick. Archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more him, less of me, laying down the red carpet, putting that podium in place, handing off the mic right up there with Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, Peter the Threes. How are you? How can people get a hold of you? And, man, you're bringing this guy in here, another legend, that comes in once a month. Take it away, and I'll man the boards, my brother.
All right.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. It's my name, Peter, J.REA. And you're absolutely right. Tonight's guest is the author of four tremendous books, Bench Bosses, the NHL's Coaching Elite 2015, The Art of the Dealers, the NHL's Greatest General Managers 2017, Lords of the Gridiron, College Football's Greatest Coaches in 2019. And he's got two books coming out in 2026, Baseball's Greatest Managers and the NBA's Greatest Coaches. Welcome to the show, Mr. Matthew DiBiase.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, Peter, Mark. It's always great to be back, man. And we're going to have a lot of fun tonight. Two great coaches.
Yeah, well, it's always fun having a once every 4 weeks having a nice talk about NFL history. And tonight we're continuing with your book, the guys in your book, Lords of the Gridiron 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches 2022, and starting out with two guys from the 70s, starting out with number 40 on your list, George Allen.
George Allen. One of my favorite moments, you know, looking back at, you know, at my favorite moments in NFL history is the aftermath of when the Washington Redskins won the 1972 NFC Conference Championship game against the Dallas Cowboys, 26-3. It's New Year's Eve, 1972. And they're all Coach Allen and the Redskins are in the locker room. This is the over the hill gang. I mean, most of those guys, by football standards, are practically doddering. A lot of them are over 30 years old, and yet in the aftermath of victory, they're all acting like 18-year-olds, you know, doing rah-rah stuff. And it's a beautiful moment. I mean, he takes a bunch of oldsters and he injects them with this fountain of youth, and they're acting like 18-year-old kids, and they actually lead the Washington Redskins, their first Super Bowl appearance ever as a franchise. And it's one of the great moments in NFL history, and it's certainly a great moment in Washington Redskins history. And George Allen was the man who orchestrated that. I mean, this is a guy who never, ever had a losing season as a pro football coach. He took two franchises, the Los Angeles Rams and the Washington Redskins, both of whom had long-term bouts with failure. I mean, with the Rams, I mean, they hadn't been to an NFL championship game since 1955, and yet, you know, twice he came so close to taking them to the Super Bowl, only to lose in the NFL semifinal rounds there. And then he takes over the Washington Redskins, who hadn't been to an NFL championship game since 1945 and hadn't won an NFL title since 1942, and yet he took them to their very first Super Bowl appearance, Super Bowl VII, where sadly they lost to the Miami Dolphins. But he was an incredible man. He was born and raised in Michigan. And then he very small. I mean, he was not a natural athlete, very small, but he overcame his lack of size with iron determination. I mean, he just willed himself. And even if he couldn't perform physically, he always wanted to understand the mechanics of the game, of all sports, but especially football. I mean, he was just so studious. And his first coaching post was at Morningside College in Iowa. Had a rough trial by fire, but then he was able to get them on the winning stop. Then the next stop was Whittier College in California, which ironically was Richard Nixon's college alma mater. In fact, that was the thing that linked the two together. Those two were very close friends. I mean, when Allen took over as head coach of the Redskins, I mean, he and Nixon both would have these long twilight conversations because Nixon couldn't go to sleep. He was a night owl. And George Allen, of course, was a workaholic. So they would call each other like in the wee small hours of the morning and just talk, you know, talk football and things and all that. And even after Nixon got ousted by Watergate, George Allen always spoke up on behalf of Richard Nixon, always, you know, was an advocate for him. And George Allen eventually got through with Whittier. He became an assistant coach with the Los Angeles Rams under Sid Gilman because Sid Gilman, like George Allen, was a film freak. He was a workaholic who just – he could spend hours upon hours looking at game film, dissecting it and reading keys and figuring out strategies. And he saw the same thing in George Allen, made him a wide receivers coach. And then after 1957, he was let go by Gilman, and then he got hired by George Halas, where he was director of player personnel. And it's ironic. Allen was, of course, famous for trading young draft picks for veterans. But when he was with the Bears, he was actually he drafted very good. I mean, he was getting good players, you know, Ronnie Bull, you know, trading for Larry Morris, you know, Joe Marconi. He drafted Mike Ditka, Dick Butkus, Gale Sayers. I mean, he had an eye for rookie talent. And then over time, he became the defensive coordinator, replacing legendary Clark Shaughnessy. And what he did was he revolutionized the Bears' defense. Basically, Shaughnessy's systems were extremely complicated. Lots of, you know, difficult verbiage and signaling and all that. And what Allen did was he simplified everything. He just made the calls more simpler, the more formations more simpler. And he built one of the greatest defensive units of all time. In the 1963 Chicago Bears, they won the NFL title. But basically, they allowed opposing teams only 10 points a game. I mean, that's how great their defense was. And in the 1963 NFL Championship game against the New York Giants, who had one of the finest offenses in the NFL, they held the Giants to 10 points, intercepted Y.A. Tittle five times. And both of their Chicago's touchdowns, they won 14-10, were set up by long-distance interceptions that got them inside the Giants' red zone and led to quick scores there. Take away those two interceptions, and the Bears probably wouldn't have won that game. And he was given the game ball afterwards, and his stature grew. And then finally, in 1966, the Rams hired him, but not without a fight because George Halas did not want to let George Allen go. In fact, for a time, there was like a brief hope amongst the Bears players that Papa George Halas would retire after 63 and Allen would take his place as head coach, but Halas didn't retire. But he did not want to lose George Allen. So he used the local Illinois courts to stop Allen. And finally, it took some negotiations with, you know, Pete Rozelle and the Rams front office and Halas. And finally, George Allen was allowed to coach the Los Angeles Rams. And in his first season there, he led them their first winning season since 1958, I think it was. Yeah, 1958. And then in 1967, he leads them to their first divisional title. And actually, to get there, they had an 11-1-2 record. And the last 2 weeks of the season, they had to beat the Green Bay Packers and the Baltimore Colts, two very powerful teams, just to win that divisional title. And the two great games. I mean, that game against the Packers, they had a block punt to set up the game-winning score for the Rams. And then against Johnny Unitas, they battered him and they won 34-10. It's one of the greatest performances in Allen's career with the Rams. But they lost in the first round of the playoffs against Vince Lombardi's Packers, who went on to win Super Bowl II. Thing is, Allen had a weird relationship with Rams owner Dan Reeves. Dan Reeves developed one of the finest scouting and drafting systems in the NFL. I mean, very influential, one of the most innovative owners in NFL history. And he didn't like the idea of Allen trading away all those beautiful draft picks for all these veterans because he did the same thing with the Rams like he later did with the Redskins. He traded away draft picks and got experienced players like Jack Pardee, Eddie Metter. Eddie Metter was already there. Myron Patios, and a whole bunch, Richie Pettibone, and a whole bunch of other guys. I mean, very quickly, he made the Rams one of the most devastating defenses in the NFL. He had the fearsome foursome in Deacon Jones, Merlin Olsen, Lamar Lundy, Roger Brown, Rosie Greer. I mean, they were devastating. And And another George Allen innovation, which he used with the Rams and later with the Redskins, was that he revolutionized special teams play. He, along with Bud Grant, were one of the first coaches to realize that the special teams unit need not be consisted of cast-offs, that you could make your special teams, your kicking teams, an elite unit where they could, you know, block field goals, block punts, and actually steal wins, you know, by blocking kicks or returning kicks for touchdowns. I mean, he used top-notch personnel in his special teams units, created special drills. Dick Vermeil got his start as a special team coach under George Allen with Los Angeles. And then later when he went to Washington, he got Marv Levy to serve as his kicking team's coach. And both Los Angeles and in Washington, his special teams units were one of the finest in the NFL. I mean, that win against Green Bay in Week 13 of 67 was a result of a blocked punt. And the Redskins' sole touchdown that they scored in Super Bowl VII came out as a blocked field goal attempt. Mike Bass recovered and ran it all the way for a touchdown. I mean, again, he made it a genuine, powerful third unit in football, and thus revolutionized, you know, NFL tactics forever. And but the thing is, you know, in 69, they won 11 straight games and then lost the last three regular season games, and then they lost in the semifinals to the Minnesota Vikings. And they almost, Reeves almost fired him, and it took a petition from the players saying, we'll quit if you don't bring back George Allen. And they brought him back. But in 1970, the Rams failed to make the playoffs, and finally he was fired, but instantly he was picked up by the Redskins. And, again, using the same formula, he, again, traded away draft picks for veteran players. In fact, here's the funny thing. He took 11 players who played for him with the Rams and brought them over to the Redskins, and they were called the Ramskins. You know, guys like Pardee, Pettibone, Rosie Taylor, you know, Dyron Talbert, you know, guys like that. He got Billy Kilmer and other veteran players, and Charlie Haraway, and they were just, you know, no, wait a minute, Haraway was over there. And again, he turned the team right around. His first season there, he got them a wild card berth, and they lost in the first round. And then the following season, they won their first divisional title and went all the way to Super Bowl VII. I mean, it was his greatest season in Washington. I mean, it's the only time he ever made it to the Super Bowl. I mean, his defense is. I mean, he was always reading game films, and he was always picking up keys. And what his defensive systems were was, if you knew the tendency, you were supposed to be able to anticipate the play. I mean, you would just be able to, in other words, certain down and distance situations, okay, they're going to throw a screen pass, so they would anticipate the plays. And then when they guessed right, they were devastating. I mean, forced the turnovers. Offensively, he was just very conservative. Just maintain possession, don't take any unnecessary chances. You know, just move the chains and just score the essential points, as it were. And they made it all the way to the Super Bowl. But the thing is, they took on the Miami Dolphins' perfect season dynasty, and they just couldn't break through. I mean, Miami contained Larry Brown. They forced Billy Kilmer, who was not exactly a pure passer, to throw, and they were able to get two interceptions. They pressure, you know, they contained the Redskins' ground game, and they basically, in a battle of the defenses, won 14-7. And George Allen never really got that far with the Redskins ever again. I mean, he was able to get, you know, playoff appearances, you know, wild card berths, but they always get eliminated in the first round. And also, he was wearing out his welcome in Washington. He was very profligate when it came to salaries, because he would, you know, he was like the GM as well. I mean, was it Edward Bennett Williams, the owner, once made this famous remark? He said, "We gave George Allen an unlimited budget, and he's already way exceeded it." And eventually, he was let go, and for a time, you know, he was never allowed to actually, for a brief time, he was rehired by the Rams under Kyle Rosenblum, but ironically, he got fired after coaching only two preseason games. He replaced Chuck Knox, who left, you know, after 77, but he was fired after two preseason games and was replaced by Ray Malavasi, and he never coached in the NFL again. And for a time, he was doing color commentary for CBS, and he always felt he was being blacklisted. And then when the USFL was formed in 83, he took over and coached the Chicago Blitz for one season. Then he transferred over and coached general managed the Arizona Wranglers. And again, he made his teams winners, but they couldn't win the USFL championship. And then finally, when the USFL folded, he was just retired for a time. And then, ironically, he went back to college football coaching, a tiny little college. It was Long Beach State University. I mean, it's a pathetic little college. I forget, was Division II or Division III. He took over and actually led them to a winning season in 1990. He got a Gatorade bath, and sadly, 44 days after he got that Gatorade bath, he died of pneumonia in his home. He suffered, was it ventricular fibrillation and all of that. And he was inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2002. But just what an incredible motivator. I mean, he could get anyone excited. He could just make you young again. I mean, he involved everyone. He wasn't hostile to the press. He would award game balls to writers who would write up the team. He would award game balls to anybody who he felt helped would help the team win. I mean, he would pull out all the stops at all times. And he was a favorite of mine. I wish I could have played defense for George Allen.
Yeah, I from the 70s, I remember him well, and those rivalries between the Cowboys and Redskins and Roger Staubach and Billy Kilmer and Tom Landry and George Allen and his enthusiasm. And I read a wonderful book by his daughter called Fifth Quarter by Jennifer Allen. And the daughter, and it really is interesting because she talks about, you know, his dad, her father's working all the time and is driven and – and it's a very touching story about, you know, her trying to please her father and, you know, and even have time with him because he was so busy. And these poor fellows are trying to do something basically almost impossible, which is winning a championship every year. And, you know, George Allen just, you know, he got to one Super Bowl and lost. And so the frustration, these guys are all frustrated because they just can't. Every year they don't – you're not going to win the Super Bowl. Only one – especially now it's gotten – tougher. But anyway, George Allen was, I remember him very well. His friendship with President Richard Nixon, really
yeah.
Interesting. And Billy Kilmer, NFL Films, John Fonseca says, oh, and here comes Billy Kilmer with his belly hanging over his belt, trying to will the Redskins to glory. You know, so anyway, George Allen, wonderful coach from the I remember him very well from the 70s. Now, moving on to the next guy on your list, number 41, Chuck Knox.
Again, kind of obscure, but a very innovative head coach who, one of the best in the 1970s, Chuck Knox, came from Western Pennsylvania. That seems to be not only a breeding ground for great pro quarterbacks, but also for pro coaches as well. That in the Ohio area, you get a lot of coaches coming out of that area. Grew up in very rough circumstances. I mean, what you could call it by today's standards like an abusive home. I mean, it was very rough for him. But football was like a way out of the mean streets of Sewickley, Pennsylvania. He sports was like a form of salvation for him. He became like a – after he left college, he was doing assisting football coaching and teaching at a high school in central Pennsylvania. And then in 1956, he got a full-time head coaching job at Elwood City High School in western Pennsylvania, back home again. And for the remainder of the 1950s, he was developing his football players. And actually, some of his players were recruited by colleges like at Wake Forest and other universities there because he was developing a good program. And one of the coaches who he used to get his students from had a vacancy for an assistant coaching position at Wake Forest, and he asked Knox, would you be interested in taking a job? And Knox decided to go up the ladder. In other words, leave high school coaching and coach in the colleges there. So first he's working as a coaching offensive lineman at Wake Forest, and later he moves on to Kentucky, where he serves under Blanton Collier, who we talked about months and months ago, who was also featured in my book. And Blanton Collier, he educated Chuck Knox about offensive lines. Knox about how to use your eyes, you know, how to follow defensive linemen with your eyes so they don't get past you. And it really revolutionized, you know, Knox's football education there, opened doors for him. I mean, Collier did that for like Don Shula, Howard Schnellenberger, you know, a whole bunch of coaches there, and he helped revolutionize, you know, coaching there. And finally, Knox stayed there for a time, and then he got the attention of Weeb Eubank, a Paul Brown apostle there. And Weeb Eubank had just taken over as head coach of the New York Jets in 1963, and he needed an offensive line coach. He got Chuck Knox. And what Chuck Knox did was he spent 4 years coaching the Jets' offensive line. When he took over, they had one of the worst offensive lines in the AFL. They had 34 sacks. By the time Chuck Knox left, you know, after 1967, they were only allowing 17 sacks. And one of the things, one of his improvements was that he developed a new blocking technique, basically that leveled the playing field in the battle between pass blockers and pass rushers. What he was he was one of the first coaches to get offensive linemen to block with their open palms. Before that, you had to have your hands tucked in and all that. But what he did was act like, as he put it, he said, act like you're guarding man-to-man at basketball, basically hand-checking. You're not so much grabbing, you're just hand-checking. Just like you would stay between your man and the basket, you should stay between your man and the quarterback. He said back then defenders were allowed to grab and shove, and then you use the head slap. But with using offensive linemen, you know, using their hands there, they were able to buy some time and keep the defensive linemen off. And what happened was that the Jets, with Joe Namath as quarterback, were able to revolutionize pass techniques because they were able to buy extra time for Joe Namath. They were using deeper square-out patterns. Before that, a square-out pattern may go like 5 or 10 yards because you only had 3 seconds to pass. But if you had 4 or 5 seconds, that meant your receivers could go deeper, like 15 or 20-yard square-outs. And that really spread opposing defenses, their zones, even further, and that opened up a lot of holes. And that's one of the reasons why Joe Namath was able to, you know, like pass for 4,000 yards in 1967 and then later lead the Jets to the Super Bowl III championship, even though Chuck Knox was gone at the time. Because when the 68 season started, he crossed back over to the NFL because the Detroit Lions needed an offensive line coach under new head coach Joe Schmidt. And he took over, and he actually improved the Detroit Lions' ground game. He helped, you know, he developed guys like Ed Flanagan, Rocky Freitas. They were Pro Bowlers, 3-time All-Pro tight end Charlie Sanders. They actually got some good yardage there. 3 times Detroit finished in the top 5 in the NFL in rushing yardage during Knox's 6th season at Detroit. Now, when Joe Schmidt left after 1972, Knox had the hopes of taking over as head coach of Detroit. But apparently it wasn't in the cards, and then the Rams reached out to him and asked him, would you please be our head coach? And he jumped at the chance, and he took over the Rams, and he's able to develop one of the finest ground games in the NFL. He had 2 running backs, Jim Bertelsen and Lawrence McCutcheon. I mean, McCutcheon was unproven, yet he made him a 1,000-yard rusher, one of the finest running backs in the NFL. He acquired John Hadle. He had Harold Jackson at wide receiver. And for 5 straight years, from 73 to 77, he led the Rams to the NFC Western Divisional title and into the playoffs. But there was one problem with Chuck Knox, and this is one of the reasons why he got fired in Los Angeles and then later on with Buffalo and then later on with Seattle. Chuck Knox had the worst playoff luck you could ever imagine. He was the second heartbreak coach in NFL history, according to my calculations. For those of you out there listening who haven't heard this term before, I invented this term called a heartbreak coach, which is you can apply it to any of the 4 sports, football, baseball, basketball, or hockey. It's a coach who can get a minimum of 5 playoff appearances, yet is incapable of leading his team to the championship finals or the championship game. Chuck Knox had, I believe, 12 playoff appearances with all of his during his entire NFL coaching career. Not once was he able to lead a team to the Super Bowl. Not once. And for a time, he was the greatest heartbreak coach of all time until finally Marty Schottenheimer passed him. And that was his bane. I mean, he had 5 straight playoff appearances with the Rams, and he always crapped out. And finally, the Rams got rid of him, and then he went over to the Buffalo Bills. And the Bills were, like, in very bad shape, and yet he was able to get a great running back in Joe Cribbs, and he got Buffalo back on the winning track and was able to get them into the playoffs there. But again, Buffalo just couldn't make it. They couldn't get it into the Super Bowl. And finally, Buffalo got rid of him, And he went over to Seattle, and he was, for a time, before the arrival of Pete Carroll, he was the greatest coach in Seattle Seahawks history. He led them to more playoff appearances until Pete Carroll came. But again, he just couldn't get Seattle into the Super Bowl. And that was just, that was the killer with Chuck Knox. But he when it came to offensive line work, he was very innovative. But I don't think he's made it to the Hall of Fame. No, he's never earned induction. But I think he should be worthy of it. Because like Don Coryell, he revolutionized pro football blocking and running and all of that. Just like Coryell revolutionized pro football passing. And I hope one day they will induct him. I think the fact that he didn't win a championship, I think it's going to tell heavily against him. After he got fired by Seattle, he just retired, lived quietly, and then he died in May of 2018.
You're talking this book about him being a forgotten figure in NFL history. That's why it's good you're writing about him. We're talking about him. I remember him well. Here's a quote that he said, Chuck Knox said, "A man must make himself from whatever he is given. Play the hand you're dealt. It was my first and foremost Knoxism. It's easy to figure out why. It means look adversity in the eye, then kick the hell out of it."
Yeah.
He could tell from his coaching he had a tough childhood. He had this sort of hardness about him.
Yeah.
And you mentioned how he was able to, because of his roots in western Pennsylvania, help the Jets have Joe Namath sign with them in the AFL instead of going to the NFL. So that was pretty cool. And let's see, Chuck Knox. So, yeah, a lot of you wrote about he had the unique ability to see a player not as they were but as they could become.
Yeah, yeah. One thing Phil Olson told me is that when I interviewed Phil Olson, he gave me great chapter and verse about Chuck Knox. He was a coach who genuinely cared about his players, not only what they did on the field but also off the field. He wanted his players to grow, not just on the field but off of it as well. I mean, there was real genuine empathy. I mean, Phil Olson really sang Knox's praises. I mean, that's one of the reasons why they performed so brilliantly in their regular season, because he could just get them performing at a peak. But he said the problem was once they entered in the playoffs, they couldn't get beyond that, though. He said there was always a drop-off because they were already high. You couldn't take them even higher, and that's probably one reason why they couldn't go all the way to the Super Bowl. But he was very beloved amongst his players.
Yeah, Chuck Knox. So we've been talking about tonight with Matthew DiBiaz, NFL history, George Allen and Chuck Knox. Do you have anything else you want to talk about with George Allen or Chuck Knox?
Figures from the 70s. I mean, they took teams that were losers and they made them into winners. They were very much a product of their times. I mean, George Allen was big on the ground game. He had Larry Brown. I mean, it was the 70s were an era of the ground game, whereas the 80s and the 90s and 2000s were a passing era. This was a running era. You had all those great running backs, Larry Zonka, Larry Brown, Franco Harris, Lawrence McCutcheon, you know, Chuck Foreman, and guys like that. I mean, just they were great runners. You know, Tony Dorsett, Walt Garrison, Calvin Hill. I mean, it was a running backs era there, and these were guys who helped create and make that era the great era that it was.
Our guest has been Matthew DiBiaz. We've been talking about his book, Lords of the Gridiron 2: Pro Football's Greatest Coaches 2022. Time has flown. Matthew, do you have any final words tonight for our audience?
Yeah. At 10 o'clock, I will be interviewing hockey writer Randy Drusen about her latest book, Between the Pipes, her second book about NHL goaltending. My show is The Package Tourist, and I'll be posting it online, so stay tuned for that. And Thursday night, I'll have a show with Pittsburgh sports author David Finoli.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I love talking about. I love this show tonight because I thought, oh wow, George Allen and Chuck Knox. This is my childhood. These two fellas, and so I'm so glad we got a chance to talk about them and bring them back to life. We'll have Matthew back in 4 weeks. On May 7th, we'll talk about Weeb Eubank, who coached the Baltimore Colts and New York Jets from 1954 to 1973, and Sid Gilman, who coached the L.A. Rams, L.A. Chargers, San Diego Chargers, and Houston Oilers from 1955 to 1974. Next week, we have the starting center fielder and leadoff hitter for the coolest MLB team of all time, Mr. Bill North. And in 2 weeks, we have Ed Vosburgh, MLB pitcher from 1986 2002. Thanks so much again for a wonderful show, a wonderful stroll down NFL history memory lane, Matthew DiBiase.
Thank you, Peter. God bless you, man.
God bless you. Thanks so much. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again so much, Mr. Matthew DiBiase.
Thank you and amen.
Wonderful.
All right.